everybody, and welcome to this episode of the Hair to Camera Podcast. I am your host, Marshall, and this is my co-host, Dylan.
Hello, hello.
And, you know, today we are in the precipice. It's always a wonky time when there's like you're in a pre-order window and then you're in a launch window, because they're technically two different times for the things in Warhammer, but obviously in our case 40K. So while we are within the window, I thought it would be apt to talk a little bit about our good friends, the Eldar, today. Our elven Chads and Chadises. Don't worry about the name scheme I'm giving out here. Just roll with me.
But this isn't what we're titling the episode.
Chads and Chadises.
Eldar, Chads and Chadises, an Eldar story.
Just love the idea. Fucking Giga Chad Eldar.
The fourth edition of Chads and Chadises just dropped. Who will you be playing as?
It's not going to be anyone that's... Oh, I don't know. I don't know if anyone's going to like the fourth edition. They're going to make it too video gamey.
Why
won't
did
be
the,
able to do it anymore.
Why do the Chads have a distinct advantage in these skill challenges over the Chadises? That feels really unfair.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, it's like they get 20% extra of the rolls that the Chadises do. It's really weird.
A lot of these skills that the Chadises could probably do really well at, but they're not allowed to use them. It's really, really odd. I hope they clear that up in the 5th edition.
I don't know. I mean, I think if they clear it up in the 5th edition, the problem is they're going to be predisposed to not be as good just because they don't have the experience, the culture and experience that they otherwise have.
Okay. And we're still talking about the Eldar, right? That's what we're here for today? Okay.
So today we're going to talk about the Eldar, but we're not going to be just talking about the Eldar, because obviously we already went over the overview, so now it's time to get specific. So kind of like how we did with the many Space Marine Legions, today we're going to talk about the major Eldari craft worlds.
Craft worlds.
Yeah, so obviously, like, we talked about craft world Eldari as a whole, like, and that was especially in the realm of, like, the, you know, their the path, especially the path of the warrior, you know, what is a craft world, you know, kind of how do they relate between them, Exodites, how did they manage the fall, all that stuff. But today we're going to talk specifically about just what are the craft worlds, these specific major craft worlds that exist for the Eldar and have obviously helped shape Eldar into the 41st and 2nd millennium. So, yes, let's start off with then kind of a little bit reminder, kind of bring ourselves into the fold again. So, as we know, prior to the fall, craft worlds were these vast continent to small moon sized trading ships. And, you know, these inevitably had just these self-contained communities of just hundreds to maybe thousands of Eldar families. And, you know, these trading missions could end up taking them thousands of light years away from Eldar civilization, which honestly, in some respects, especially as it went further on towards the fall, kind of became a benefit, because all of a sudden, you know, especially if any of them phoned home or whatever, we're kind of like, y'all getting a little weird over there? Like, What you guys doing over there? Like, this is getting a little weird. As the final kind of time going into the fall, they became kind of the life rafts, if you will, of any sane Eldar hoping to escape the cataclysm, which was the birth of Slaanesh and the opening of the Eye of Terror.
Oh.
Yeah, so then, you know, in each of these craft worlds themselves, they have their own webway gates, which is inevitably how a lot of these craft world would kind of get their stuff actually back. You know, the craft world itself didn't have to travel back to, you know, Eldari space, right, to bring the trade and everything back to, I guess you could say, the kingdom of the Eldar. You know, they would use the webway for on various various ways. So, and in such, obviously, is how they're able to now make their way in and out of anywhere across the galaxy, but still have their, you know, craft world be kind of safe and away in most cases. We'll maybe talk about a time where that didn't happen, but we'll get to that in a minute. But obviously, since the fall, they have now grown greatly in size, taking in more and more refugees, and obviously procreating, as they will. And so they are approximately, they could be estimated to be around 10 to 100 times bigger in volume than they were before the fall, maybe minus one. We'll get to that. And the big thing, though, about craft worlds is that while we will, in the future, we're going to talk about more about the Aspect Warriors, which are the, you know, very big, specific, you know, you like very big, specific, like warriors of different kind of, what's the word, like not trades, because like craft
specialties,
craft
focuses.
Yeah, specialties, focuses. Yeah, yeah, exactly. You know, they have their foci where, you know, then in the craft world, especially what, you know, as I noted in the first episode, as guardian defenders and other defenders, they are just the common person, and most of just the common person, they, if they go along, if they choose to go along the path of the warrior and not the seer, even though seers in some respect get military training, but they will be military trained. You know, it's kind of like how in like places like South Korea and a number of other countries where it's just like you turn 18, you get your, you go do your time in the military.
Yeah. And then, standing army.
Yeah. And then if we were going to be available and then like, or like if we were invaded, like, then even if it's been like 5 years or like 10 years, you're coming in. Tag up. So, and obviously Craft World Eldar do the very same thing because of the necessity of them being this kind of hunted by demons and potentially dying race. And many of them then also, of these craft worlds, then have relationships with Exodite Eldar as well, given that they have, they're definitely going to be militarily stronger, and they will, they have kept more of the advanced weaponry attack that the Eldar had prior to the fall. All right, so our first craft world that we are going to talk about is going to be of Alytok. These were, for example, one that you could play as in a campaign for in Dawn of War 2 Retribution. And otherwise, they are the most known for being, one way or the other, I feel like every craft world has some like warrior known thing. Like when I was doing my research for this, it was one of those things where like, it was like, you know, they became known for their militaristic thing. And it's like, okay, so I feel like if they're all known for their militaristic aspects, then like, that doesn't become like, it's that thing of like when everybody is special, no one is special kind of thing.
Yeah, it would have to be more specific. Like, is it like a weapons, like this group is known for using specific weapons. This group is known for like using particular tactics. But if you just say like everyone is known for having a military, it's like, okay, yeah, but that
right
doesn't really do a lot to, you know, highlight
exactly
them.
Yeah, so like and that's the thing I had to kind of get into. So one of the big things that they are really pushing on is that they really like press their people into kind of becoming different types of exarchs. You know, these are obviously, as if you recall from the original episode, these are the Eldar who take up various aspects, the Aspect Warriors, and really entrench themselves into it. Exarchs are known to be those who like truly, who choose to never remove, you know, that stay stray from that path or change their mask or take off their war mask. So like they press so many people into just kind of sticking into the mantle of war that it's funny because like it's one of those things in Eldari culture where if you kind of decide that you don't want to go along that path anymore, you in some regard kind of outcast yourself in a way. Now, as we mentioned that episode, that doesn't mean that you necessarily always holistically cut off, because one of those functions can then be a ranger where you are not part of an aspect, but instead you move freely throughout the galaxy and return to and essentially scout for your craft world so you can return and grant information. But in a way, what you are giving up is the promise of like being, you know, like an, you know, an autarch, being in charge, right? Yeah. That's what you're giving up. But so because of that, though, and because of this rigorousness, Alytok is known for the highest number and efficiency of rangers. And so, like, Alytok rangers themselves are known as Star Striders. And, like I said, don't stay upon the craft world, but travel the galaxy and, you know, can return on occasion to kind of give information. Other rangers in different craft worlds might have more direct ties or stay, maybe able to kind of stay as more connected than, say, maybe the ones that Alytok do. But the Star Striders are specifically known for always kind of being aloof and away, you know, and then returning in times of need or information or warning, you know, like, you know, being like, if they hear like, ah, the Alytok soldiers are coming, or there are going to be a bunch of ones from Alytok, and then they come back and they're like, it's a tomb world. Careful. Don't go there. You'll await there. You'll awaken them. Stuff like that. You know, obviously, like, it's like, that's an important thing because they still have an allegiance, right? They are allegiant to Alytok still. They have not, like, totally abandoned and gone full.
They haven't completely
like
severed ties. Yeah,
they haven't gone like full Corsair, you know, the pirate life for me. And so, and thus, though, because of this push, obviously, to make more Exarchs, they obviously still have a very unusually high number of Exarch. So that means, obviously, that they also then have many Aspect Warriors, because those who, obviously, to become an Exarch, you must be the Aspect Warrior in the first place. and thus, they are kind of in that middle ground of, like, not having maybe necessarily or utilizing maybe necessarily as many Guardians, because they kind of have, like, a lot of people getting pushed into the, like, the full path of, like, you know, going Ranger or Exarch, and not as many, like, just being like, I'm just a guardian, you know, I'm just here doing my time. But obviously they have the guardians nonetheless. The other thing that they are also the most known for is that they believe and they hold that the Necrons are the greatest threat to the galaxy. This is specifically pushed by their Farseer. I'm gonna destroy this name. Yoloku Shai. I mean, you tell me. It's Y-L-O-C.
I don't know. Yoloku Shai? Because I mean, I feel like I'm pretty outgoing.
Yeah, oh my god. I was like, what? Well, like, then I got it.
That was a stretch.
It was a little bit, but I got it. I got to it. I was able to catch it. And so this Farseer, though, as kind of reminder, Farseers see into the future, the far-seeing. And he kind of saw the rise of Imatek, the Storm Lord, and kind of saw that, like, he and the kind of empire that he would create would be the ultimate threat to pretty much all life in the galaxy, let alone just Eldari life. Which is funny to me because, like, this is despite the occurrence of the Tyranids, right? But there's kind of two two sides of the coin to look at this concept, right? Where it's kind of like sometimes Eldar, it feels like Eldar looks so far in the future that sometimes it almost feels like they forget about the now, right? That thing of like you're looking so far ahead that you don't see the branch at your feet.
Yeah, you're seeing all the trees in the distance, but you're not actually looking at the forest in front of you.
Right. And then, you know, but again, maybe not, right? Because maybe they are seeing the steps along the way and thus are, you know, anointing their ways about it. Like, for example, maybe Yolokushai knows, hey, these craft worlds are making the effort and they are pushing and helping humanity deal with the Tyranids. And we know, hey, when they will do that and they will be successful, but we need to start prepping. We need to be the ones that start prepping for when Imatek becomes a problem and maybe prevent him from becoming a problem in the first place. What I always kind of look at is like the fun kind of grimdarky aspect of the Eldar being that whole kind of like they're almost like the epitome of that story of like just because you can tell the future doesn't mean that you necessarily have the ability to change it because your actions are what are going to create that in the first place. So it's that unbeknownst and unknowing self-fulfilling prophecy.
Mm-hmm.
But that's always kind of like, I think the fun part about how that can work. Cause obviously like future guessing and everything and any type of like, any type of like medium can always be like a whole thing. But kind of as I mentioned before, there is on the plus side, some capacity to play with a lie talk, obviously outside of the tabletop where you can kind of just do whatever. They'll make detachments. I haven't really actually looked at all of the detachments for the new Eldari Codex. But I know in the past there have been, and there kind of always will be, these different ones that will be like help you be very ranger focused, you know, have a lot of stealth snipery tactics, and that mm-hmm. type of thing will obviously be beneficial for a lie talk or kind of fitting towards it. Previously, they were very much known for like having a lot of buffs to especially things like, or having like rules that really benefited Swooping Hawks and thus Autark Skyrunners, or Wayleapers. I forget the unit name, but yeah, like, because they were just like, essentially the whole detachment gave them the benefit of being able to be like, flying in and be like, hey, what's up? Bang. All right, see ya. Just disappearing. And it was just like, God damn it. Leave me alone. Let me shoot you. And that's kind of how they do warfare in general, which I imagine is annoying for those who are fighting in lore as well. So
yeah.
I feel like it's fitting. But next up, another kind of Dawn of War classic Eldari craft world, that is Bealtaine. It's famous for its inhabitants' militancy. It's in a different, this, their special way is,
oh, them too?
Yeah, I know.
What?
It's funny that these Eldar wear green helmets, because the way that they think of the Eldar, you'd think they'd be wearing red hats with white text on it. These Eldar want to make Eldari great again. The silence is deafening.
I don't even know what to say.
Okay, but in a way, I'm not. Well, it's a strong joke for your modern day. They
for
are,
your modern sensibilities.
Yeah, these are very much like their whole thought and belief is that they wish to, you know, be able to bring the Eldar back to the strength that they were at before the fall. I mean, their symbolic rune and like emblem literally stands for reincarnation, you know, and they want to see their ancient empire restored.
Sure.
And thus they obviously do so in by engaging in affronts on, you know, especially planets that they believe are, you know, like the they're like ancient worlds, and those that they kind of believe are like essentially ransacking the once beautiful planets that they had, you know, because like, while I mean, there was a lot of depravity when it came to plenty of the Eldari stuff leading up to the fall, they definitely didn't like completely just ransack and industrialize planets the way the Imperium does, the way those good old humans do. Nothing like humanity to add pollution to a world and destroy its environment.
Can't be beat.
Yeah.
Record holders.
Undefeated.
Undefeated. Every jersey up in the rafters.
And thus, especially Bealtaine will make a lot of pushes to do that. They are also well known for being the homeworld to Yavrain. And this would somewhat kind of lead to a little bit of division at some time later. But they are also, as kind of noted, and they were the, technically they were antagonists, but obviously when it came to the ones that you could choose whatever you wanted to do, for most of the Dawn of War 1 expansions and games, they were the Eldar of choice for campaigns, or Eldar of enemy for the games.
Okay.
Well, because like for example, in Dawn of War 1, the campaign is only the Blood Ravens campaign, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, yeah. So they are known for that. Otherwise, it was kind of within that realm of Yavrain's kind of coming up, because we'll obviously have a whole discussion about the Yanari themselves at some point. We'll obviously get more into Yavrain's backstory in that. But, you know, she kind of goes off and does her own thing at some point in time. So she goes from Bealtaine. She goes, kind of does her own Corsairi, Drukhari thing, right? And then goes into the Yanari, like, in a way you could say cult, because obviously it's from just the definition, obviously, how a cult works. But anyway, yeah, so that comes together around this kind of similar period or point in time, the craft world of Bealtaine is besieged by a demon called the Mask, and let me double check. And Scarbrand. So they're getting double whammied by this Slaaneshi demon, because obviously Slaanesh always wants to go for the Eldar, and always just Scarbrand going for them skulls for Khorne. Because Khorne may not ask for Scarbrand, but Scarbrand still gives him skulls. And it was within this fight that Yavrain had returned with the Yanari and a number of Phoenix Lords to close the Webway portal that they were using essentially to be able to get into the craft world. Because there's been various different points in which Slaanesh and demons have tried to like break their way into the Webway, because while it's this pocket dimension, it's somewhat to this realm where they can kind of just like knock on the door a little bit and then try to like bust their way through in some cases. There's a whole segment of Kamara that actually has that like whole background. I think we mentioned it in the Drukhari episode.
Mm-hmm.
And thus kind of obviously Webway portals can make them make themselves gateways if they are not protected and kept the right way. And thus, yeah, so the Yanari and the Phoenix worlds made this push by kind of closing the Webway portal that was going to the craft world on the planet of Ursulia. And while their effort was successful, not only did a number of demons penetrate into Bealtaine before the portal was sealed, but the Mask, the demon on the very left of this image here, had made its way into the Infinity Circuit and destroyed just a bunch of the souls in there. And unfortunately, it was kind of with this that Yvrain then had used a number. Part of this may not be fully correct, but it's just one I was able to gather. That Yvrain had taken a number of the souls or borrowed or kind of took a number of the souls to resurrect that avatar and create that avatar of Yinian, which then was able to deal with the mask, get Skarbrand away and out, and create calmness to Bealtaine, right?
Okay.
But the problem is now between those the Chaos Wars, those who then joined the Inari, which are a number of its followers and even high-ranking people, essentially, you know, Bealtaine was just that had lost half of its former population. They're kind of spread out. So they have become a lot more in recency dependent on their Wraith constructs, not as much as a different craft world, but it definitely has made those who stayed back a lot more fanatic about this kind of whole, you know, let's return to the old ways kind of concept. So it kind of puts them in a strange spot, but I mean, inevitably it's one of those things, right, where like, you know, if Yvrain does become successful, you know, even though that a number of its people went to go help her, if she is successful, you know, not all of the Eldar have to die anymore in order to defeat Slaanesh, right?
Right.
Because that was like the long-standing belief, is that in order to kill Slaanesh, all Eldar are going to have to die.
Yeah.
And we'll actually kind of have a note about that when we get into the Aspect Warriors in the future, kind of sooner than later. But yeah, that is actually kind of a whole thing with some of the Phoenix Lords. But next up is going to then be Craftworld Iyanden. We talked about them a little bit once when we talked about how they use the color scheme that you were kind of a fan of. You had spoken of kind of not one that you had seen very often and thought would be cool to have.
Yeah. A little bit of that blue and yellow or blue and gold.
Yeah, because like the Elitok is blue and gold, but like it's mostly blue and then with yellow accents, where they are mostly yellow with blue accents. And I'll tell you what, this is a controversial color and it comes to fans. There are people who hate this color scheme, and there are obviously people in your stance where they love the color scheme. In my opinion, obviously, is those who really don't like the color scheme know nothing of color science and don't know much about the color wheel. But obviously, like, there are also, I think a lot of people get very put off when something has a lot of yellow.
I actually agree with that. And even though this is a color scheme that I obviously love and we've talked about before, I think I might have even said when we were first talking about it that like a very large excess of yellow, I'm not usually a huge fan of. But it's the blue combined with it really helps to make it interesting to me.
Right, yeah, because if you look at the Imperial Fists, you know, then you'll have mostly yellow, a little bit of red accent, and then like white and black, right? Like it's mainly like yellow, white, black, red is like the order of like most shown to, and like that similarly has kind of, I would say, like a varied level. But I really like having a lot of yellow. I think yellow as a base color is actually very, I think it's cool. It's a color I think that gets very underrated. But Iyanden themselves are actually they're good for a couple of firsts amongst the Craftworld Eldar. So for example, these would be the first they're most known for then having being the first to locate Waystones and create the Infinity Circuit on the craft worlds, because, you know, obviously the fall happens and they're like, What's that itch at, man? I just feel like this weird, oh, that's Slaanesh. Uh-oh. we need to come up with a solution. And, you know, there were ancient times where they had created these waystones to capture and save Eldari's souls. Honestly, oftentimes in the past, it was likely used just to essentially just create immortality. It was probably way more in the past as like a very nihilistic thing. Not nihilistic. Oh, it's a different N-word. It's the egotistical, like...
Narcissistic.
Narcissistic, yes. Kind of narcissistic. They kind of like self-serving and very somewhat yes, narcissistic kind of... Yeah, idea of immortality. But now it's obviously way more about the survival of a species, right? If we just can try to not lose all of our souls, find a way to make this work, then at least, you know, we maybe will survive as a species. So it really changes over time. But yeah, they had hoped to kind of then use this to help rebuild themselves, you know, kind of and reconquer the galaxy as well. So they had at the beginning, they were inseparable to Beal-Tan, right? Because they both had the same goal, you know, let's make the Eldari great again. Yes, I'm making the joke mm-hmm. again. But that mm-hmm. was their goal, right? They wanted they were going to bring back and reconquer the galaxy. Unfortunately, the ways that they wanted to do it were a little bit different. You know, Ayandin kind of wanted to see it a little bit more in that realm of like, let's get, you know, obviously let's get our people going. Let's get, you know, kind of the, especially like very invasive species gone and out of the way, right? So like, you know, they both hate orcs, for example, but like, you know, really trying to get rid of the destruction, where like Beal-Tan was just like, let's just genocide everyone else. It was different. Like, Ayandin just wanted to essentially own the land. Beal-Tan wanted to kill the people. Or the mm-hmm. not even people, but the beings, you know? They're like, you know, let's just genocide all the humans that have conquered these galaxies, or these planets, you know? Let's get rid of the orcs. Let's get rid of the Votan. You know, let's get... they find the Tau. Let's get rid of them, too. That would have been their mindset, you know? Whereas Ayandin was just like, let's just get the planets back. As long as we own the planets, we can deal with the people in it, or the beings on it, outside yeah. of the orcs. The orcs can just go. No Eldar generally wants to keep orcs around. But anyway, the so then early on with the Ayandin, then around the 37th millennium, they had ended up becoming allies of convenience with the Imperium, as they had to fight back and hunt down the fallen dark angel known as Zemon, Zhemon. I say Zhemon because that kind of makes sense, because it sounds like demon, or just even saying Zemon for that matter, but still, one way or the other. He had laid much to bear against Ayandin going into it, which is why they kind of were like ready to... like, we're dealing with this. And it's like, fine, you want to help? Okay. And eventually, you know, they do kind of deal with it. But because of how oppressive he had been, this had led them to become then the first as well to call upon their dead and bring them into the battle. So the first then to bring the Wraith constructs, your Wraith lords, your, you know, the different walkers, and deal with this chaos space marine and thus chaos battle that was ahead of them now. And eventually then what they did is, you know, they were able to deal with Zhemon, and they are able to, they essentially gave him to the Dark Angels, because they're like, it was that thing of like, they saw the future and they were like, yeah, he's going to have a way more pain and just a bad time with you Dark Angels versus mm-hmm. if we took him prisoner. You got him. Have fun, sport.
Yep. Go have a good time.
Yeah. So they had left him out, but yeah, but obviously, yeah, like the big thing was that in that kind of final, I am looking at one, looking slightly ahead of myself. But that was a different story. But yeah, so obviously, like, this had so much, that was the big thing, though, is that obviously they became kind of known for having brought forth, you know, these Wraith Lords and kind of realizing, like, yeah, like, we can make use the souls of the dead while we do not wish to disturb them, because they take great care, wanting the dead to not, to stay dead and be able to live within the spirit of the craft world, right? They would obviously kind of realize, all right, we might need to do this sometimes. Foreshadowing is a narrative device in which a storyteller gives an advance hint of what is to come later in the story. So then one of the next kind of big conflicts for Yondan was with a sect of High Fleet Naga. So Yondan generally actually came pretty clean from this fight, but they were kind of warned that there would be this kind of greater threat to come. Like, because the thought was, like, they, you know, they were like, we beat the Tyranids. This went really good. We've got it. We know how to deal with the Tyranids. Nothing bad can happen. And then a Farseer showed up and goes, foreshadowing is a narrative device in which a storyteller gives it. That's what all comes to a head, is High Fleet Kraken shows up and just bodies Yondan. They are not ready for it. They just get smashed. And thus, like, they've got to bring more and more seers into the game. They've got to bring Wraith Lords, which, again, they don't like, but, like, they've got to come out. And it ends up being a really bad time for Yondan. So, you know, they end up in this whole fight lose about 4/5 of the population of their craft world. Like, they are devastated.
That's a lot.
Yeah. And so their craft world kind of ends up being populated by the Waking Dead, effectively. Like, there is more ghosts in their halls than there are living people. Because that is kind of the cool, fun things about Eldar, is that, especially in the craft worlds, is that, like, they actually, when they're in the Infinity Circuit, they kind of can, like, be around and kind of almost walk the portions of the craft world, because they're on, you know, Wraithbone, and that's all psychically connected and all that, right? You know, so they can kind of, like, be around and communicate and kind of give guidance, you know? And, man, there's a lot of people, and there's a lot of Eldar in those walls. So they suddenly have to have just so many Wraith Lords in their army, right? Like, mm-hmm. There's just nothing to help them except for just essentially now just being elf necromancers, you know? Which is 100% why I love them, because I love the idea of being like, yeah, I know you're dead and all that, but, like, man, I need your help. Into the mech, ghost. You thought Evangelion being Shinji's mom was one thing.
Hey.
Wait until now Shinji's mom is in the mech. Hey.
Careful, dude. You're going to spoil that there's mechs in that anime. Can you not?
Yes. Otherwise, one of the most notable of characters from Yondan is that of Prince Uriel. He was kind of, we actually could honestly get into more of a discussion with him, but he was kind of originally, the TLDR of him is, you know, originally he was the second in command, as he had kind of come up, and saw the efficient destruction of the high of their dealing with their segment of High Fleet Naga. Obviously, yeah, like, they didn't push back, like, the whole High Fleet. It was just obviously whatever segment of them that they've dealt with. You know, it obviously takes a whole heck of a lot to deal with the whole entire High Fleet. But it was in a battle against Chaos Space Marine Argan Calyrax, that he's just from like some war band. But he had kind of naively left Eondin a little defenseless. Kind of, you know, here's the thing. He was kind of recommended, you know, go all out, take, just obliterate Argan, right? Like, just take him out. And he kind of took that as like, all right, like very literal, and just like brought everyone to him. But this, what this ended up doing then is Calyrax kind of just like held in and was like kind of in his last act of defiance, was like, hey, that craft world over there doesn't have a lot of people by it because they're all right here. Let's blast my ship right into them. And they're able to deflect most of what would have been horrifically devastating missiles to the ship. But that one that made it through led to the death and destruction of not only thousands of Eldar, but their spirit stones.
Oh, okay.
So they were like dead. And to an Eldar, that's like devastating. Because kind of, especially you got to remember, like, you know, all Eldar kind of have like that very like extra, you know, extra emotion to them. They felt that.
Yeah, they really feel it.
Yeah. And so it was kind of within that then, you know, that he kind of was like, he was cast off then, because in a way then he, even though it was somewhat within guidance, you know, he made that decision as it was. So that's how it's just got to be. And so he kind of becomes this Corsair leader. But he does return during the Eondin's battle with Kraken. And he comes back with Corsairs and many other outcasts, you know, and saves and pushes back Kraken to save what was left of Eondin. I mean, if he didn't show up, that the craft world would just probably have died. But because of Eondin and the reinforcements he gave, they were able to survive. Much like Théoden at the Battle of Gondor, when he rode in with the Rohirrim. All right, I'll stop. I'm not gonna be like the aviation guy, aviation facts guy. I don't have those memorized. I can't do that. But no, they owed him a lot, and they actually brought him back into the fold with Eondin. They kind of realized, like, hey, thanks, man. You're not exiled anymore. You're cool with us. We're cool now. So today, now they remain as a craft world, and they have just a ton of Wraith constructs, and are, you know, just trying to find different ways to rebuild with the Farseers, you know, working with the Yanari. Obviously, Uriel trying to do what he can, but just trying to do what they can to keep to surviving. Otherwise, next up, we've got Saemhan, the current poster boys of the Eldar when it comes to the box art.
Yeah.
Technically the book poster boy is Fuegan right now for 10th edition, but they are still like the ones on the, like, if you get a box of defenders, it's their Saemhan. And now, obviously, while they get, like, again, we've talked about it, all these craft worlds have militaristic things. These are regarded by other craft worlds. So, like, other craft worlds view them as wild, and is a wild and dangerous nest of barbarians living on the edge of Eldar society. So this is what the Eldar think of Saemhan.
Yeah.
And the reason partly for this is that, you know, they are believed to be kind of one of the first to kind of go off in the craft world, and thus have gone the farthest away from Eldar society. And so to them, their big thing is, you know, that like the path is still this just like form of control over Eldar life. But what it lets you do is that if you hold to the path, you can still then experience, like essentially responsibly experience, the wild and carefree ways of old, right? And thus the other Eldar view this as being horrifically dangerous, because if you let yourself have emotion and, you know, a little bit of wild times, you know, picking up your whatever friend from the bar and having a one night stand, like that's crazy talk to the Eldar of other craft worlds. But, you know, maybe you're willing to experience some things that you could have if you were a normal Eldar. But that's because you go to church on Sunday morning and all is forgiven. It writes you out, you know. Obviously, that's somewhat more of a, that's obviously a different type of social commentary. But like the reality of that is that's, they do hold the belief that, like, because they still believe and hold to the paths that they have, they are able to then experience life outside of that normally or have fun with what they do. For example, you know, they are known when they fight to be proud, boisterous, and aggressive. They love to use fast jet bikes. So they'll, you know, you'll find them like always just coming in with plenty of jet bikers going around. And they, the guardian, like young guardians always are just kind of trying to like outdo one another, you know, very like Gimli and Legolas. I'm bringing a lot of Lord of the Rings reference today. Very Gimli, but like very Gimli and Legolas kind of vibe, you know.
Who would have known that when you're talking about in elves, battle,
you know,
it would, you know, invoke feelings of other fantasy
what
titles. It's crazy.
What do you mean? What? That's crazy. You're crazy. That's what do you mean? But they then are also very well known for having what is called the Wild Rider family. And so this, including the Seers, so you know, you'll see like warlocks on the jet bikes as well. And they are, especially a great many of them are the specialists who ride jet bikes and vipers, you know, these fast moving, you know, kind of air vehicles, you know, whether they're bikes or kind of like, oh, almost like a jet. Like, and the families of these wild riders maintain a fairly feudal hierarchy, you know, kind of ruled by one Eldar, and that rule is kind of passed down through hereditary, you know, hereditary tradition. You know, like I said, like obviously it's very, when I say it's feudal, like I really mean it. Like it's very like, and obviously, like I think one thing that should be kind of somewhat made clear to this point, but it's like a great way to bring that into fold, is like, The Tau get a lot of smack, obviously, for being called the Weeaboo Space Communists, you know, because they have the mechs, you know. But the Eldar are, like, obviously very samurai-inspired. Like, you can just look at this jet bike rider, right? And just, like, where do you see the samurai, Dylan? Do you see it? It's just like, it's so funny to me, like how they kind of get like the pass almost on being called like weeby compared to Tau, because like,
yeah,
they're about as weeby as it gets. Whoever created all this like Eldar lore here, like clearly was like real, like was just a humongous, you know, feudal Imperial Japan fan, like history fan.
They're weeby in the way of like the Romance of the Three Kingdoms instead of your like, you know, 70s into 80s mech and science fiction and anime, things like that. Like your
right.
your OVA VHS tapes that you would have watched in the 80s and the 90s. It's basically just a different, it's like a completely different time period of Japanese interest.
Yes, it's the difference between the person that loves watching, you know, old school samurai movies versus the person who watches anime.
Yes.
Sometimes maybe those things cross over a little, you know? Maybe there's
you'll get a Senran Kagura every once in a while. But.
Yeah, but otherwise they generally are a different realm of, like, especially culture from that. But one of the things you can kind of actually see this is in the book, the Yanari book, Wild Riders. The main character, you know, kind of has to, well, his family is like trying to convince a number of the other families and whatnot to essentially help the Yanari and deal with it. And it's kind of like, obviously there's like a bit of random, like, kind of politicking and whatnot with it, but like that's it kind of gives a decent example of like what it looks like to kind of see this like familial feudal discussion, because like the whole thing, especially going into it, is like their dad is definitely getting old, you know, he's weaker, he's trying to move, but like they obviously try to keep the face, right? Because he's kind of like, while there are the many families, he's kind of like proposed as like obviously the high leader of the like the grand family that they're a part of, right? You know, because it's kind of that thing of like, obviously you wed and political marriage in various places, so like there are different houses, but like technically they all link to one, right? Mm-hmm. They're trying to kind of denote that like their family is still currently the head. So, and if, cause like when he dies, it's going to be a whole shamble. So it's like, and they're like trying to keep up this whole thing. It's a very cool insight into like kind of how the Seimhan, if you like Seimhan and like the Shido and the Wild Riders thing, it does give you a really cool glimpse into it. Obviously then it gets into a whole Yanari stuff afterward, but like, it's an interesting prospect. But they then also solve internal conflict through ritual combat. So your kind of duels and whatnot. I have not always seen necessarily these. It would be surprising to me if any of these were specifically to death. It's not necessarily an Eldari thing to do since the fall. So I don't. As far as I know, I believe that these are not meant to be non. These are meant to be non-lethal. I could not, for the life of me, find a strict answer to this.
Okay.
Maybe I'm just bad at researching, but like I kind of took it that it doesn't seem right that they wouldn't, right? Because why the hell, when you're looking at yourselves as this dying race, would you kill each other, right? In this way. It's different when they're like, it's a different craft world. It's two different craft worlds maybe having a disagreement or fighting with each other. Because like, again, it's kind of like, you know, it's like, you know, it's like France fighting England, you know, it's like, yeah, they're both European, but they have very different cultures and they can have giant disagreements, but like, so it's kind of like that, but like in this scenario where like literally survival is everything, it would be weird if this ritual combat led to death. But like obviously the act of doing such things is seen as barbaric. if it's not lethal. From the other the craft worlds. So, you know, take it as you will. But they're definitely a great craft world to get into if you like really like the combat and the bikes. Especially like kind of this feudal family thing, they've really got that going on. Otherwise, finally, we've got Craft World Ulthway, another prominent featuring clan or Craft World of the Dawn of War series, the mostly seen throughout Dawn of War 2 up until Retribution. And And then the mysterious third Dawn of War game that just never came out. It's a real shame. It's a real shame that Dawn of War 3 just doesn't exist. I actually have, I had a small intent. I was like, I should go back, do like a proper thought process on like, play Dawn of War 3. Let's take Dawn of War 1 and 2 out of the equation and just view it as a game. Was it even a good game in the first place, right? Obviously, it should fit some lore aspects, right? Because like one of the biggest things that people take in that, this is a digression, I know, but like one of the things that obviously people take from it is, you know, the fact that it's like, oh, you know, Gabriel Angelos does a front flip for a hand into a hammer smash. That's not really a space marine thing to do. You know, and you know, a video game's a video game. I think there are realms of that that you can kind of give a pass to. So I actually think it would be fun and curious to do that as like a real retrospective on like, do we not like it just because it's not a good Dawn of War game, or is it really just a bad game? Because obviously, I would make the argument that it doesn't have enough factions in it, right? But that was the classic Dawn of War thing to do, which was start with a few factions and then go into having everyone else by like your third expansion, right?
Yeah.
Very old school computer gaming thing, right? That's just kind of how it was. But outside of that, I wonder kind of what that how that judgment would go. But anyway, Ulthway, they are our final one, and they are one of the largest and obviously thus most populous of Eldar craft worlds remaining since the fall of the Eldar. They were also one of the kind of the last ones to leave the Eldari Empire, and thus were caught in the gravitational pull of the Eye of Terror. So it just kind of began now orbiting it. Like kind of almost like the Eye of Terror is this like planet, and it just kind of lives perilously close to becoming absorbed and then are obviously thus under regular attack from those who pour out of the Eye of Terror. Kind of like how Cadia was constantly under besiege from the demons, you know, until CSM took that fat W and those Cadians took a big L. But is also kind of why Ulthway was actually pretty predominantly around and assisting humanity with Cadia prior to its falling. So they did try to help, but unfortunately it was not necessarily to a great success, as obviously we know what happened to Cadia. But they otherwise, you know, have kind of had a number of different aspects to them. They are, though, one of those who, while they have a number of psykers and whatnot, a lot of them kind of do end up going into realms of especially warlocks. They see many of those who essentially, like, you know, are they... Sorry, like, yeah, so, like, a lot of the warlocks and psychic warriors will continually go and follow different warriors into battle, whether they are guardians or aspect warriors. And they are often seen as kind of being more advanced than a number of the other craft worlds. And they are then also believed to see further ahead with greater precision. Oh my God. and while they have been victorious over demons a lot of times, Ulthway definitely was a bit left reeling after especially, you know, a more recent a demon incursion, and is kind of in the midst of a bit of some civil strife right now. There's kind of three factions emerging through portions of Ulthway. The first and largest of these is the Seer Council, and they kind of continue to just dispatch forces, kind of push back against chaos and the Great Rift. The final group is the Yanari. They are just those who have obviously gone away. This is kind of an issue, though, for obviously a great many of the craft worlds. You know, they're not, while they're not necessarily against the Yanari or people going to the Yanari, it's one of those where it's like, you know, it still really puts us, though, at a disadvantage. Like, I'm not mad that you're going, but, like, this is going to be tough. Mm-hmm. It's going to be, it is, it's sad to see you go because we could have really used you. You know, that person that quits your coworker that quits where you're like, damn, I'm really glad you're going, but it's going to be hard to do this without you.
I respect it, but also, oh God.
It's going to be rough for a while. And then the final group are the exiles led by Aldrad Ulthron. I almost said Ulthway. He's Aldrad Ulthron of Ulthway. But obviously, and he has been heavily involved recently, though, with the growing cult of Yinead. He and his exiles have kind of gone in and around of the craft world space over a great number of the millennia. I mean, he was for a long time, though, one of the main leaders of Ulthway itself, and obviously still is in many respects. But he, much like Ulthway, loves to interfere in the affairs of other races, especially more than any other craft world. Now, the Imperium has definitely put Ulthway as supposedly being, you know, responsible for a number of devastating events, including the Second War of Armageddon, but I don't necessarily know how true that really can be. But nonetheless, that's kind of what they do. It obviously could just be Imperial propaganda. But Eldrad, being one of their most talented psykers, has, you know, in the past, for example, tried numerous times to warn the Imperium of the impending betrayal of Horus. One of those times being trying to talk to Fulgrim, which, if you haven't gotten to that part in the book yet, obviously, if you could guess, probably doesn't go super great.
Oh, I'm sure it'll be fine. I'm looking forward to it, honestly.
Yeah.
I think it'll be great.
Definitely, he's not going to sniff out that potential Slaaneshi corruption. That's going on in him at some point. Mm-hmm. It was, I believe, that he did initially die during the Black Crusade, but he had came back within 6th edition of 40K, and thus has been seen alive and kicking since then. But he's now kind of described as kind of in his last days, almost crystallizing, but still very much alive, you know. Obviously, he was also similarly instrumental in the resurrection of Gilliman and helping the Yanari with said thing. He had also helped the Yanari. Oh, man, I'm going to fuck up the name. And this will be more of a thing to talk about later. But it was like the hand of something. But it was this like very specific art, kind of chaosy artifact that was held by Nurgle in the warp, obviously. And he had kind of helped set the Yanari up to be successful on this task. So he is definitely around. And one way or the other, futzing around with things in the current millennium, and I'm sure we'll be seen again soon enough as more and more, especially as we see more and more of Fulgrim. I'm sure it'd be, especially in that new book, I kind of wonder if they'll have maybe some type of interaction, a secondary interaction between Fulgrim and Eldrad, because I don't think we've seen another interaction since that book. So it would be interesting to see 10,000 years later, what do they have to say to each other? But yeah, otherwise, as I've kind of alluded to, for the tabletop, the Eldari are getting, they're getting their codex. The pre-orders had gone up at the within recency, and then they will come to public, you know, public sale and shop availability in the near future. Here, it's always tough to gauge like what those gaps. Differences will be, it might be within the next 2 weeks. You know, like the day that this comes out, for example, is technically going to be the release date of Guard. And Guard went on pre-order like a month ago. So kind of hard to gauge sometimes how GW does these releases. But they, at the start of 10th edition, were busted. they have had to have so many nerfs over the course of 10th edition. And honestly, it kind of seems like the game balance folk over at GW. It's funny because the Eldar always feel like they're in this weird middle ground where, like, they, you know, like in lore, it feels like GW hates them. But in tabletop, GW loves them.
Interesting.
Because one way or the other, it always seems that in every edition, like, Eldar somehow become broken, one way or the other. And, like, the way it was at the beginning of 10th edition, for example, in their index, was they had, like, a pool of 9 dice. It's kind of like Sisters, where, like, you would roll these dice at the very beginning of the game, and then you could substitute these rolls for these dice throughout the game, right? But they obviously then had a bunch of abilities that let you turn a lot of those dice rolls into sixes so that you could just turn like one of those 9 dice that maybe was a 1, now it's a 6, you know? And they had a bunch of abilities that helped them do that. So they were really oppressive, and a lot of people do not like playing against the Eldar. And I'm just bringing this up, obviously, because now people are definitely worried about that coming into the new codex. Because obviously there's been a codex release, tease, whatever, since we did the first episode. Kind of why I felt like bringing it up again. But generally you will find any of these detachments to very much kind of be based on the different, you know, the different craft worlds, you know. They often always have kind of, you can kind of play them in your various ways. You know, for example, in the new codex, there is going to be, you know, like a very wraith favored detachment, right? You'll have your, you know, guardian kind of helping and focusing ones. You'll have, you know, just, you know, you kind of will be able to fit the bill that you wish to, you know. You can have a lot of vehicles. You can have a lot of guardians. You can have a lot of aspect warriors if you really wanted to go for it. But one way or the other, if you want to kind of design your own craft world or take a part as the ones that exist already, there will seemingly be a detachment for you. But otherwise, any questions about the craft world from you?
No, not really.
You got a craft world that you seem to jive with the most?
Let's do a quick review, run down the list of all of them again, because I feel like there is a certain one I'm kind of leaning towards.
Right. Okay.
Sure. Let's run down the list.
All right. So yes, we've got our TLDR recap. We've got Alytok, heavy on your Exarchs and Aspect Warriors, and then Rangers. Very love to be stealthy. Yes, Bealtan, love to just be like all out warriors. You know, plenty of guardians, plenty of vehicles, plenty of wraith constructs, but just love the, like, have just like the warriors and superiority kind of mentality. Decent amount of psychers too. Eondin, big on the wraiths. Use a lot of, you know, wraith lords, wraith knights, wraith guard. They have a lot of their psychers are spirit seers, which are those that kind of shepherd the wraith constructs into battle and care for them and repair them and fix them and all that. And then you've got Samehan, the other very warrior-y ones, but in the sense of being more blissful, kind of white scarsy, you know, fast mm-hmm. jet bikes, kind of enjoying the thrill of battle. Not necessarily maybe being as emo as many of the other Eldar are. and then you have Ulthway. Love to metal. Very, though, very psychery focused. Lots and lots of psychers, yes. But otherwise very well-rounded as well in terms of the amount of guardians they have, the amount of vehicles they have, the amount of wraith constructs they have. But love to metal. Crazy about meddling.
My thing is that I'm kind of between the Bieltan and the Eandan right now.
Yeah.
I'm kind of in between those two if I'm trying to, like, decide a favorite.
Yeah, I mean, Bieltan's got, I think, a lot of cool going for it. Mm-hmm. It's just funny because it's another one that isn't a big fan favorite on the color scheme. I think the only thing, I think the only part of the color scheme that I can get a little bit off with maybe is their guardians, where a lot of times the guardians will be very white with a little green, right? It would like it to be cool. Maybe a little more even, but that's paint job. You can do whatever the hell you want in that realm.
Yeah, we kind of look established at these, this a bit in the last episode of, like, you know, at some point it kind of comes down to how you decide to paint them.
Exactly. I mean, look at the, like, vine things on the serpents, you know, like
it's interesting to me because it is so, that vine pattern is something that I look at that and I'm like, that doesn't feel like Eldar to me, period. It has like a real, how do I describe it? It's like if all the Eldar showed up for like a family gathering and then you've got like the cousin that shows up in like the fox jersey with like a Monster energy drink while everybody else is dressed in like, you know, formal, like, you know, blazers and ties and everything. And then you've just got that cousin that shows up in the fox shirt and hat and the Monster energy is just like, sup, how's everybody been? Like, that's what
the white monster,
this like scheme gives me. And I don't hate it. I think I kind of appreciate it for how much it like stands out compared to these other, all these other craft worlds.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. But yeah, I mean, Eandan's definitely my personal favorite because I love Wraith Constructs.
Say Eandan.
Yeah, I mean, I love Wraith Constructs.
I love their symbols too. The Eandan symbols are really cool.
Yeah, I mean, it's like part of it's like meant to represent the like return to form that they were like looking for.
Yeah.
I think Wraith Constructs always look cool. Like the Wraith mm-hmm. Knights there, like they look awesome. And then, you know, I think Uriel's story is also really cool. Like kind of his like he has like supposedly he has this like whole cool speech too, like very like literally very like King Theoden like ride speech.
I was gonna say is it more King Theoden
I know
or more like,
but like
Chaplain,
I did that analogy because like he does apparently do this speech and I couldn't find it anywhere because I wanted to make sure it was right, but I couldn't find any quotes anywhere. And granted, I had to do some pivoting. So like this was maybe like, I didn't have the amount of time to try to find it as I would like. So if somebody does find it and can post in the comments, it'd be great. But like, he does apparently give this speech that's like very like in that feeling. And it just sounded like it would have been really cool, but like Uriel seems like a really cool character. But then, yeah, I just love the concept of just like essentially like, look, when I was told like these are Eldar necromancers as a craft world, I was like, I'm sold. Because I love necromancers and fiction stuff. Oh, it's sick. But I mean, Bieltan's definitely got like the warrior, the way they do their kind of warrior aspect, I think it's very cool, but I think my second would definitely still be Samehan. I feel like I just really love the like you know, the very white scarsy nature. And it's like why I like the white scars in the first place, you know, like the joy, being able to relish the joy of combat. I love bikes.
I love bikes.
I like bikes. Cool. But yeah, no.
All right, look, I'm gonna lock it in. I'm gonna lock it in. I'm gonna say Bealeton first, and I'm gonna say Aeondin second.
All right, we're hitting the Bealeton. I mean, we're
gonna
like,
do Bealeton first. I'm gonna say Aeondin second.
Yeah, I mean, I'm definitely here for it. It's they've got a lot of history, like. I obviously definitely spoke the most about Aeondin, but partly because of the firsts that they did. Mm-hmm. You know, like if they didn't have those firsts, I think it would have obviously then helped aid the other ones. But, you know, like they do have just like a really strong culture. And yeah, I mean, like I think the white and green especially could. Like, you just give it maybe a little bit extra flavor on, like, the way they've got, like, the... Like, I don't think actually the green and white and green look as bad, like, for example, in this art. I don't think it looks as bad, say, on, like, the Wraith Guards there. But, like, you just add a little flair to the Guardians there, mm-hmm. and then it'd be awesome. It'd be sick.
Yeah.
You know, like, looking at, like, the Rangers in the back of this picture, like, they look cool.
Mm-hmm.
But also, you know, I just think Eldar are cool, man.
I just think they're cool.
I just think they're neat.
Yeah, exactly.
But that's going to do it then. We will talk about something next week. I once again come to you without a topic tease for next week.
We'll figure it out. I'm not done with Fulgrim yet. We got to wait on Fulgrim.
We got time left, at least, though. We're good. We're still good. Yeah. But otherwise, thank you guys so much for listening and or watching. And we'll see you next week.
Goodbye, goodbye.